The show is live and local. It's your connection to local performances. And our topic today is a performance that will be given, actually two performances to be given Wednesday evening at the Iron Post in downtown Urbana at 6 and 9 p.m., featuring pianist Lawrence Hobgood and tenor sax player Ernie Watts. Two great names in the world of jazz. Lawrence Hobgood, a multiple Grammy nominee and 2010 Grammy winner, along with vocalist Kurt Elling, for whom he is the longtime musical director. And we have Lawrence in the studio with us for the full hour. We'll be hearing from some recordings and also hearing him play live for us. I'm looking forward to it. Hope you are too. It's live and local on FM 90.9. That was called They Say It's Wonderful from a CD called Dedicated to You. Kurt Elling sings the music of Coltrane and Hartman, as in John Coltrane and Johnny Hartman, which also featured the Lawrence Hobgood Trio, Clark Summers bass, Ulysses Owens drums, and Lawrence Hobgood on the piano. And that is by way of introduction to Lawrence Hobgood himself, who is with us in the studio today. He's going to be in Urbana at the Iron Post on Wednesday night for a couple of shows, back-to-back with tenor sax player Ernie Watts, who also shows up on that CD. We'll sample a little bit later. 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock on Wednesday, and probably best known as a collaborator through his musical directorship of Kurt Elling since 1995, but also with lots of other people like Ernie Watts and other names that we can drop all over the place, Larry Coryell, John Petitucci, Regina Carter. I'm just looking at the ones that I happen to know myself, Christian McBride, Terrence Blanchard. I mean, the list, this is a huge list that goes on for a rather long paragraph. So it's really a privilege for me to finally meet Lawrence Hobgood. I've met his mom. I've met his sister. I've heard you with Kurt Elling at the Krannert Center before, but I've never met you before. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
And even though you're living at least some of the time in Chicago, it was nice to... Not at all?
No.
You came down from Chicago then, didn't you?
Yeah, we were performing in Chicago this weekend, but I live out... I actually live on the south shore of Long Island, which sounds really great, but it is. But I'm not one of the rich mansion owners out there. I found a nice little sort of I'm like sort of a Nick in the Gatsby story situation. I live in a little cottage on a private property that's owner occupied near the ocean.
I was going to say cottage on the beach. Right?
It was quite and I found it on Craigslist. Believe it or not,
you can find everything.
There
Craigslist.
You go. Not to give a plug for Craigslist, but there it is.
Yeah, it's free, you know. I mean, not that the house was free.
No, but I wish.
using Craigslist is free. Yeah, so what does it mean to be the musical director for somebody like Kurt Elling? I mean, I think most people probably assume if Kurt Elling is doing a CD, then Kurt Elling is producing his own. He may not be producing the record, but he's his own master, right?
To a very great extent. Kurt and I have what I think of as a true collaboration in that we work all the ways that you can imagine, ranging from him having the idea, let's just say a repertoire idea, and being extremely sure of exactly how he wants to do it. And in that case, my job is to facilitate something that can be very, very specific that he has in mind, but inevitably there's a lot of mortar that has to get filled in the arrangement. So my creative outlet never completely goes away. But on the other hand, there are things that we completely, I guess, co-generate, you know. And then there are things where I will write something perhaps with him singing it in mind, but maybe not. He's written lyrics to several of my tunes that were just instrumental compositions that I wrote, and he heard something happening to those. So that's what I meant when I said true collaboration, because we really, it's not, there's no set procedure. The source of whatever the idea is might be either one of us. That said, for Kurt's records, he's gotten very, very sure of what he wants to do. But we still, you know, we talk about stuff. We're working on his next Concord record right now, and we're still winnowing down the repertoire. And I have plenty of opportunities to say, you know, let's not do that.
So is he most likely to be the one that comes up with a song and says, I want this to be on the record? Or could that be?
If it's his record, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. He's very sure. Well, the thing is, our records these days tend to have at least a subtle theme, but it's a theme that we know. The record that we're working on right now is going to have a very specific theme, which is to look at different music that came out of different eras of the famous Brill Building in New York City. It was the building right there in Midtown, 1619 Broadway. Which I believe is going to be part of the title of the record, the address of the Brill Building. Duke Ellington had a studio there. Irving Berlin had a studio there. But so did Carole King, and so did Burt Bacharach in later years. Paul Simon wrote a lot of music in there as he was launching his career. It just was this building full of, back in the day, you know, Tin Pan Alley, literally dozens of writers in their little rooms with the pianos and trying to come up with the next hit, you know.
So that's what it was famous for, was
that's
all the
right.
people who...
Yeah,
who
the Brill Building is still there. And actually, I found out last week that there is still some music studio in there. So because they're talking about, just for the sort of the symbolic nature of it, that we might go in there to do one of the tracks for the record to actually say that it was recorded in the Brill Building.
Yeah, but, why not?
I don't know what the status of that is. So, but you can see how that repertoire, you know, that's been very carefully picked. And we all weigh in on it, not just me, but Kurt's management. And we have a very, very healthy relationship with the record company. And so that all those sort of cliche but not apocryphal stories about the antagonism between artists and their record labels, we really don't have any of that. We've gotten really beautiful support from Concord, and so that means that they're involved, you know. And Chris Dunn, who's the head of A&R at Concord, works with us very closely and has very strong opinions that I respect about repertoire and things like that.
So where would he come into the picture?
On the phone. You know, on the phone, in the email, everybody's in the loop on all the decisions that are being made.
No, what I really mean is, if, you know, let's say Kurt picks a tune, you say, yeah, that seems fine with you. You start working on the particular arrangement or maybe what's going to happen in the tune. And then
we demo
he
it
might
up.
Say...
We demo it up,
yeah,
and we send it
well.
To him and say, here, for instance, we recently were looking at... I don't want to spoil the surprise, so I won't say what it is, but a really classic... like sort of, you know, Motownish R&B hit, and we were either going to do it as a walking straight ahead swing, ding dong ding 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 dong, you know, like a lighter 3/4, actually kind of a waltz, but like a moving jazz waltz treatment of it, and so we recorded both of those examples and sent them to Chris to see what he thought, you know.
And what did he think?
He liked the swinger, I think, on that one. We were kind of leaning that way too. But when we have two good ideas, we'll put them both out there and see what people think.
It's nice to. I mean, I suppose it reinforces the quality of the relationship when the two of you have a hunch and it's just supported by the guy who ultimately needs to say yes or no.
Yeah. Well, that kind of thing. Is great when that happens, and it's the more fortunate I am to be involved in all these various different projects. For instance, not to switch subjects, but one of the things I know we're going to talk about is my project with Robert Pinsky, and the last track on there was one that the producer and I co-producers of the record felt real strongly about. Robert wasn't as sure about it. And then when we were mixing it, there was something about the ending of that particular track that we were like, that's the ending of the record. You could hear it. And Richard and I both had the realization at exactly the same moment. Similar kind of a, you just look at each other and you're both thinking the same thing. And yes, then you go, okay, well, that's got to be right because we're both thinking the same thing.
So. But you still had to bring along the other guy who was the star of the show.
He agreed instantly.
And Robert Pinsky is a longtime, three-time poet laureate.
Mm-hmm. Only one in history, actually.
Any idea who our current one is? This is not something I'm always aware of, but I was aware of him, actually, for some reason.
The name eludes me. I just heard it the other day. But
this isn't meant to be a test. I don't know.
No, yeah, I should know. I was just reading an article the other day that had the name mentioned. I think it's a woman right now. I think.
Well, it's not everybody.
Let's not embarrass ourselves anymore.
No, it's not every jazz musician, though, that gets to work with a present or former poet laureate, or for that matter, who works with a poet at all.
Right.
I mean, since you brought it up, by the way, the last track on there that you're referring to called Rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a couple of tunes. Let's sample at least one of them here. In fact, the opening, I think we want to do actually the third track on here. It's called Samurai Song.
Mm-hmm.
How did you decide, or who decided to make this collaboration happen between you and Robert Pinsky?
The introduction was made by our great friend Richard Connolly. He's the Richard I was just mentioning. Richard is a born and bred resident of Nyack, New York, which is up in Rockland County on the west side of the Hudson River, just about half an hour north of New York City, and it's a very, very famous. In a kind of an underground way, it's a very famous area in New York cultural lore. Aaron Copland lived there. Hoagie Carmichael had a place up there, I believe. I know Joseph Cornell and Edward Hopper are both from Nyack, and the houses that they grew up in are basically downtown Nyack. It's kind of a Huck Finn northern style. You know, it's right on the Hudson River, and it's got that river town feeling to it, but it's north of New York City. And Richard is just steeped in the history of this whole place, as he's in his mid-60s and he's lived his whole life there. So he just knows everybody. The way we met was his Circumstantial Productions published Kurt's lyrics book, and that's how we got to know each other. And I've been doing some teaching up there and collaborating with him of one form or another, and he's one of the people of the many hundreds of unbelievable people that he knows is Robert Pinsky. So we were doing a show in Boston, and Robert came to the show, and he and I hit it off, and Richard introduced this idea. Robert actually wanted to be a musician when he was young. And I derive, let's just say, an affectionate humor from the fact that this amazing guy that I'm now fortunate enough to be friends and collaborators with was a guy who you know, couldn't make it in music, theoretically, because amongst other things, whatever his talent level was, it wasn't likely to produce a solid income in life or whatever. But so what he did was he became a poet.
As if that
you,
would
if you
normally,
see the humor
yeah, yeah.
in that, then yeah. But what a poet he became. He has a very musical, what is anathema to him is any sort of what is normally associated with poetry, dramatic reading. He reads musically. He thinks of his, if you will, recitation of his poems as a musically delivered line in terms of a rhythmic thing and the sound of it. Robert wrote a book about the sound of poetry for people to think more about that when they're, I guess, especially when they're reading something and it's not being read aloud, because the sound of poetry is incredibly important, paramount issue, and folks don't think about that as much. And this project is all about the sound of poetry. And I'm on 12 of the 14 tracks, I'm improvising. So what you're going to hear on Samurai Song was just what it seemed right to play for that poem at the time.
Let's hear it. It's called Samurai Song. The poet, Robert Pinsky, with pianist Lawrence Hobgood from their collaborative CD called Poem Jazz, heard on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
when I had no lover, I courted my sleep.
That's some nice improv underneath there. The poem by and read by poet Robert Pinsky, with the pianist Lawrence Hopgood improvising beneath it, from the CD called Poem Jazz. And it's called Samurai Song. And I was interested to know, having not heard this CD at all, as you were talking about his musical reading, mm-hmm. I was very curious to know, well, what's this going to sound like? Because there are people who, as you said, read poems dramatically, but then there's the stereotypical reading of a poem that ends up being really monotonal and non-expressive. And all. I never understood that. And as often as not, a poet will read his or her poems that way. I've never
Isn't
got
that a
that
funny
at all.
Thing?
And you'd think they'd want to express a little more than that. But I love the way you're right. It's very musical. It has ebb and flow. It has real expression mm-hmm. to it. And I loved what you put underneath it. Lawrence Hopgood is my guest here on Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and he's going to be with tenor sax player Ernie Watts, who we'll hear from a little later, not in person, but courtesy of their CD together. They'll be at the Iron Post in Urbana Wednesday night at 6 o'clock and at 9 o'clock, so two shows. Iron Post is in downtown Urbana. It's always a great place to see, a nice intimate space to see all kinds of music. They're always offering things throughout the week. So we've talked, I introduced you as a collaborator mm-hmm. with Kurt Elling and a collaborator with other people. There's the CD. This is really kind of funny. I always think this is funny with, particularly with jazz musicians, where the one we played first has Kurt Elling's picture on it, and you're listed among the performers. This one doesn't have your picture on it, but it says Lawrence Hopgood and Kurt Elling's listed on it. So you just sort of switch people around. But have you ever done a solo CD? Meaning
sure.
You by yourself.
Well, this label that you were just looking at the package there.
Name Jazz.
Is
as in Name Audio.
As in Name Audio, exactly.
Audiophiles.
And I've done 5 records for them. 4 or 5? Yeah, 5. 2 records with a trio where actually I technically wasn't the leader because it was what we call a co-op. I had a great trio with Paul Wertico and the bassist Brian Torf. And then a solo piano record called Left to My Own Devices and trio record called Crazy World. And then this record with Charlie Hayden, When the Heart Dances, that does have Kurt on a couple of tracks, being a guest on my record of all things, yeah. And I've always composed my own material, which is what the performance at the Iron Post will comprise, largely original stuff.
I mean, solo with just you.
Mixing.
Nobody else.
Mixing terms. Well, the solo piano record.
No bass player. No nothing.
Left to My Own Devices is a solo piano record.
And do you have something from there to play for us, or
wish I did. The problem is that on this trip, I hate to say it, but commercial considerations. When you're bringing along about 200 CDs in the car, you find yourself not bringing along little extra copies of this and that, because you're just concentrating on the two things.
Yeah. So what have you got? We have you here with the keyboard.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know what I thought I would do, because it's just been on my mind. I thought I would play a little bit the tune that's probably the tune that we're going to open with. Is a composition of mine called Shirakumo no Michi, Japanese for White Cloud Way.
Why Japanese?
A good friend of mine in New York is the novelist Marie Matsuki Makit, she and her husband are extremely close friends, and her mother's a a very cute, petite little retired Japanese opera singer who lives in Carmel, California. And when I was looking for the right title for this tune, I had some help from them. There's a book called The Way of the White Clouds, and it's a story of a German-born guy who became a Tibetan Lama for the rest of his life and lived there. One of his duties was to go around to all the different monasteries and sort of check in with them and, you know, however that works in that particular very different lifestyle. And it's just an amazing, a very uplifting, interesting book. And it just matched the feeling of this tune. And so that's how the title became White Cloud Way. But the particular thing was to make sure that the title in Japanese, Shirakumo no Michi, would actually make sense to someone who's speaking Japanese. So you're not just stringing some words together in a way that Japanese people would not use them. So I had my advisors helping me out to make sure that I was doing something that had at least a modicum of integrity to it.
As far as the language goes, anyway.
As far as that goes, yeah.
Well, your playing has plenty of integrity. I'm curious to hear it with a wonderful title like that.
Let's see what happens.
Lawrence Hobgood, live on Live and Local.
Thank you.
Lawrence Hobgood at the keyboard here in our Studio F on Live and Local at FM 90.9. His own composition, translated, means White Cloud Way. And if I transliterated what you said anyway correctly, something like Shirakumo no Michi.
Shirakumo no Michi.
Shirakumo no Michi, the actual title in Japanese. Beautiful.
Thank you.
So how much of that was, quote-unquote, written out ahead of time, and then how much was on the spot?
Well, the only thing that's written out is the, you know, it's a, that particular piece is a fairly standard jazz vehicle as it appears on the page, so it has the melody and chord symbols and the, you know, obviously shows you what the form of the pieces, and other than that, that's it. It's all made up.
But there's a, you know, but there's a, it sort of reminds me a little bit, there, I heard many years ago when I sang in a choir at an Episcopal church in Winnetka, Illinois, we had a guest organist give a recital, and he was very famous for his improvisations. And usually you think of an organist as playing, you know, these grand written out pieces. And I found it virtually unbelievable that everything he was doing in these massive kinds of pieces was improvised. And I talked to somebody else later, and he said, well, what you end up doing is you have a certain bag of tricks, and you also have in advance some ideas of things you might do, and then you just kind of put them all together. And I wondered if that's a fair summary of a lot of what happens.
The fairness of it.
But for a composition, to call it a composition, you've got to have an idea of what the tune sounds like and what the basic, besides the chord structure, also what the basic sound of the piece.
But those are composer's arts. I think it's helpful to remember that. This is one of our favorite sayings. Improvisation is just composition sped way up. Composition is just improvisation slowed way down with an eraser. You know, and that's really true.
And rendered permanent in certain kinds of composition. in certain kinds of composition. You know, once you write it down, you erase it, you put it back together, and you leave it on the page.
True, but you know, the conceptual idea that all composers operate under is that the performance of music is not going to sound like dots on a page. You know, it's human expression. The fact of the matter is that amongst people who are musically gifted, there has always been a minority of people who had this additional ability, which some others who may be technically and expressively geniuses, but the improvisational thing eludes them. You know, some of our greatest classical, Mozart was known to be a great improviser. Bach, same thing. Other famous classical, you know, some of the most famous composers out there, not really improvisers. But the basic, I mean, to use your word, composition, look at the literal meaning of the word. It is something that is composed or has composure. The idea of constructing musically cogent statements and executing them on the spot, that's what improvisation is about. And I think that, you know, to be fair, one of the problems that that jazz has what lies at the center of it is a misapprehension about the very thing that we're talking about. Because when people hear somebody play in a way that has a clarity and a breath and a breadth and a shape to it that sounds very much like composition, because it is, it's just spontaneous composition. The more, if I can say it this way, the more together it is, I think the more people have a tendency to assume that, well, that can't be improvised because it just sounds way too together. But that's the art. That's the art of improvisation. And it has to do, another irony is that one of the catchphrases of all time is that music is the universal language. And yet people don't really think about what the ultimate depth of meaning is in that statement. It is a language. And just like people who, you know, there's a difference between, you know, some guy who's, you know, performing some sort of blue-collar work and a guy who has three PhDs in English. You know, they both speak the English language, but it's a very, very different thing for them. I'm not putting anybody down here. Well, Lord knows we need everybody doing everything that they're doing. But music is the same way, you know. And people who spend their entire lives studying the language of music, both in the sense of the names that we've invented over hundreds of years to give to everything, which are often in conflict with each other, but also the real substance of it, the music itself. Melodic construction, harmonic construction, form, the different ways that you can manipulate notes and sequence them. And I mean, that's a science, you know. And people who study that have the improvisational gift, that this is what we do. We try to tell stories with music.
Well, and ultimately it comes down to the imagination.
That's right.
Whether you imagine it, as you said earlier, on the spot, or whether you imagine it in some other way. I did this project just for myself and a group that I belonged to recently where I was listening to all kinds of recordings of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, and mm-hmm. somewhere in reading the notes to one of the recordings, I ran across the comment from Stravinsky that I hadn't run across before, where he said that the biggest problem for him in writing this piece was rhythm, where he had imagined the thing. He knew what it sounded like before he wrote anything down. And it's just boggling my mind how anybody would imagine a piece like this in the first place. But then figure out, well, I know what the music is. How do I put notes to it? Which is almost the opposite of what the jazz performer does.
Well, actually, not really. That's the thing. For instance, when we were talking about the piece I just played, I mentioned that my sheet on that was a very standard sheet in that it's the type of piece where you can just notate the melody and then indicate the chord change, what we call chord changes, the harmonic content, in a way that also indicates the bass content. Now most music has three strata, top, middle, bottom. Melody on the top, a bass line on the bottom, which those who have studied music knows that that's really the original. That's where all this came from, is a Kyrie, you know, which was essentially a bass line that the evolving canon of species counterpoint was based on, initially harmonizing to a Kyrie. And then, you know, years later, composers like Handel would definitely indicate figured bass on their bass parts, which is the precursor of the system of notation that we use now.
Figured bass meaning the harmony above the bass.
That is correct. And that was something that they wanted the bass players of the time to know. For instance, if at the particular point in the music was a C chord, if it said C6-3, then that would mean with the third on the bottom, because there was a sixth and a third, in this case a minor chord, but a 6-4 chord would indicate that the fifth should be placed on the bottom of the chord. And when you're talking about harmonies passing through each other, chords there, but you know, all of that information is important in there. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that you know, the deeper you get into something, you find out stuff. For instance, one of my revelations a few years ago was to find out that almost all of Wayne Shorter's music, going back even to the records he wrote for Blue Note in the '60s, his parts. His piano parts were all written out note for note, and didn't employ as much of the chord symbol shorthand that we're talking about. And he's one of the greatest, maybe the greatest modern jazz composer, you know, in my, of course.
And that was who?
Wayne Shorter.
Wayne Shorter.
Who first was famous for playing with Miles Davis, and then... went on his own and founded the group Weather Report with Joe Zawinul, and then has had this amazing resuscitation the last 10, 15 years of his acoustic career. And happy to be friends with the guys that play with him, Danilo Perez and John Patitucci, and the great drummer Brian Blade. So I find out stuff, you know, and that's how I found out that when Danilo first got in that band, Wayne pregs out his music and it's all written out. It's like a classical piece. And in the assumption is that if you are theoretically in the know to the extent that you need to be playing with a Wayne Shorter, that you will be able to decipher from your instantaneous analysis of these written out notes that you're playing what the chord changes are. It's thinking music. That's what it is. And it really takes all different forms. But I have a bunch of pieces where the piano part is written out note for note, just like a classical piece, because that's what it needed to be. It just wasn't enough to indicate only the melody and then let everybody else figure out from just, we'll say something like A7 means a dominant chord in the key of D flat, most likely with these certain. That's the thing on a jazz chart. If it says A7 in its most rudimentary sense, it means this. But nobody's gonna just play that. You're gonna play. It's all because there's a certain role that chord would play, most likely leading as a dominant chord to D flat. That's the music, the printed music that we read needs to indicate whatever it needs to indicate for that particular piece. And those things vary from piece to piece. So sometimes it's all written out and sometimes it's just kind of bare bones.
I'm talking with Lawrence Hobgood, who is, are you a native of Champaign-Urbana?
Well, I wasn't born here. We moved here when I was 15.
But you went to school, high school here, and at least part of college here, and now living in New York and working with so many people across the musical world, jazz world especially. He's going to be with Tenor sax player Ernie Watts at the Iron Post in Urbana Wednesday night at 6 and 9 o'clock, which is why he's here today. I'm glad you were able to come down a couple of days early as you're doing a gig up in Chicago. Which is great.
Yeah, we played in Chicago over the weekend, and then we have a few days off on this little tour we're doing. I do want to say a word about having Ernie. I mean, this guy is just it's just jaw-dropping what he does, you know. He's coming from the John Coltrane school, basically, and I mean that in the most complimentary way. He's coming from the John Coltrane school and expanding that and you know, pulling it off. He's just one of the most amazing musicians I've ever gotten to work with, and it's just effortless, you know.
Do we have him on the – we played earlier from Dedicated to You. Do we have him on the opening track?
Yes, we do. He's taking a nice solo on that, and it's my string quartet arrangements that you'll be hearing.
With a quartet called Ethel.
That's right. We love those guys.
I talked to one of those members when they were here in town. I can't remember when now.
They're great. They're great, and they played great on this record. This was live at Lincoln Center, and we only had one show.
Wow.
So we thought going into it until a couple of weeks beforehand, because of other things we had done at Lincoln Center, that we would have two shows. And then we found out very much at the last minute, nope, you got one show. And, you know, all these plans had gone into making a live record, and we had one chance to get it right. That's it.
So you had to pick 13 songs out of, what, a 2-3 hour show?
And No, it was a 90-minute show.
Oh, 90-minute show. Wow. Those are pretty good odds.
Well, I like your optimism.
No, what I mean was you played the odds well, I guess, to have come out with an acceptable record off of one short live show.
Every once in a while the stars line up and you get lucky and you perform the way you need to perform when you need to perform that way. And we managed to get it that night.
Well, let's hear it. This is the opening track from Dedicated to You. Kurt Elling sings the music of Coltrane and Hartman with Kurt Elling on the vocals and Lawrence Hobgood Trio, who are Lawrence on the piano, Clark Summers on bass, Ulysses Owens drums, and featuring tenor sax player Ernie Watts and the string quartet called Ethel. The tune is All or Nothing at All here on Live and Local. Nothing at All with Kurt Elling vocal, Lawrence Hobgood on the piano, Ernie Watts featured on the tenor sax, and then Lawrence's trio with bassist Clark Summers, Ulysses Owens on the drums, and then the quartet, string quartet called Ethel, Lawrence's arrangement of a tune originally by, is that a Coltrane tune?
Oh, no, that's a standard, and I'm embarrassed to say sitting here right now, I can't quite recall exactly who wrote All or Nothing at All.
That's what makes a standard is you forgot who wrote it, it just is the tune. It seems like happens a lot. You're listening to Live and Local, Lawrence Hobgood, my guest, and we have him for hardly any time left. The time has really flown. I need to say that our broadcast is made possible with support from Docha, presenting the 2012 Docha Festival featuring chamber music events and young people's concerts March 30th through April 3rd at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Champaign. A complete list of festival performances is at docha.org. And on tomorrow's show, I'll be having Masumi Rosted, who is involved with the Docha Festival, who preview tomorrow night's concert in the festival. There is no concert in the festival tonight. And we'll also be having an interesting live performance in our studio of somebody who plays an Asian harp, which we'll hear more about tomorrow for a performance that is happening along with a lecture in the MillerCom series at the University of Illinois. We also have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector, the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. Our spring fund drive starts in a few weeks, and we want to keep the drive short and our member support strong, of course. For every $25,000 we raise before April 13th, we'll deduct a full day from the drive. It's our way of thanking you for helping us reach the April goal of raising $250,000 in membership support. Do your part to shorten this drive by contributing online now at willpledge.org. You're listening to 90.9 WYL FM and HD Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR, classical music, and more for Central Illinois. Lawrence Hobgood will be with Ernie Watts at the Iron Post in Urbana for two shows Wednesday night at 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and those should be some really great ones. Lawrence, it's a great pleasure to meet you and great
you
to have
too.
You on the
Thank
show.
Thank you for today. Having me in.
Yeah, thanks for stopping in, and I know your mom lives here, your sister lives here, and if you ever get a chance to stop in the studio, we'll have to do this again.
Absolutely, love to.
Here's Lawrence's CD. This is one where your name is on the top of this one. It's called When the Heart Dances. In fact, we're going to hear the title track along with bassist Charlie Hayden. Pleasure to have you, and pleasure to hear this music, When the Heart Dances, on Live and Local.
Thank you.